The title for tonight's talk is Embodied Practice. In insight meditation practice, Vipassana practice, we don't concentrate the mind so strongly that we numb to our bodies. Instead, we develop mindfulness and awareness through an observation of sensory experience. We observe what is actually occurring in the present moment, in the body. We embody our practice and embody our freedom. We live with these bodies day in and day out. We have lots of experiences in them, and many of them we don't even notice. Has anybody sneezed? Yeah, you've all sneezed at one point or another. Have you been mindful of a sneeze? It's an incredible experience. I mean, it's a truly extraordinary and incredibly intense experience. To sneeze, the contractions, the tingling, that anticipation of building up to a sneeze, and then the climax of the sneeze, and then the feeling of changing temperatures right after the sneeze, and then the reorientation. I mean, it's an extraordinary experience. The next time you feel a sneeze coming on, really, really have the strong intention to be mindful of the whole process, and you will experience intense sensations. Now, coughing is also an intense sensation, the contraction, the pain, I had a cold last year. I guess it was last year. I cracked ribs from coughing. The action of a cough in the body is so strong that it actually can crack a rib. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary thing to realize that this body has its processes. But how often are we aware of them? Do we bring mindfulness to them? Do we actually feel the body as it is? Usually we get an unpleasant sensation and we just push it away, and we get a pleasant sensation and we try to get more of it. But mindfulness asks us to just experience the sensations as they're occurring, as they're changing, as they're flowing. In this talk, I want to discuss several different approaches to embodied awareness. And the first is just a simple reflection to consider, do you like your body? Do you have judgments about your body? Do you think it's too fat, that it's too skinny, that it's too tall, that it's too short, that the skin is too dark, and that the skin is too pale? Do you judge your body? I was working with mindfulness of the body recently in my meditation group at home, and I asked everybody to go home and to stand in front of the mirror, preferably naked, and just stand in front of a full-length mirror and observe their body without judgment, and to see if they could do it, to see if they could even look at their body without judgment, you know, to let the judgment go and then come back to just looking, just seeing, how is it? And it was very, very challenging because the judgments kept piling one on top of another. Oh, too wrinkly, too old, that isn't what I look like. Ooh, a little too much there, a little too little there, a little. You know, the judgments were extraordinary, and one would just lead to another. It was a real challenge. You might explore this at home. Stand in front of a full-length mirror. I don't think there are full-length mirrors here. But you could just peek in the mirror, you know, in the bathroom and see, can you even look at your face without judging? Ooh, a little bit of this, a little bit of this. When I stayed in the monasteries, we didn't have mirrors, of course, so I spent a number of years mirror-free. It was actually quite wonderful. But in the West, there's a lot of reflective surfaces, even if they're not mirrors. So you walk around just windows, and there's a lot more reflection occurring in an urban life. One of the places I like to practice is in Massachusetts in the United States at the Insight Meditation Society. And they came to a compromise because some people wanted mirrors and some people didn't want mirrors. So they came to a compromise where you open the little medicine cabinet and the mirror is on the inside. of the medicine cabinet. So, you know, you can always get to a mirror, but you have to actually open something to get to a mirror. And I thought it was a pretty good solution. So that the people that wanted the mirror to, you know, for shaving or for combing or for admiring, could have the mirror. And then those who were still blissful of in mirrorlessness could experience what it is like to just not be so self-reflective all the time, and to let go of some of those the constant stimulus through which we judge ourselves. It's quite deeply ingrained to judge our bodies. Even my teacher Punjati would, when somebody came to the gate, he would say, "Quick, go get my teeth." And I'd have to run and get his dentures and give him his dentures before opening up the door to allow somebody in. It was only in the last maybe 2 years of his life that he ever allowed anybody to photograph him without teeth. And so there are some really wonderful pictures of him, with the way that he really is, really was for the last many, many years of his life, which is without teeth. But that was very late. You know, usually it was like, "Go get my teeth." And it was quite funny because many people didn't know that he had false teeth. I don't know how they could not know. When somebody has a perfect set of teeth in their 80s in India, they're false. But he would get compliments sometimes on his perfect teeth. But we judge ourselves. I had a friend in high school who had, I had very, very straight hair. Still do. But in high school it was very long and I could sit on it. So the weight of it would make it even straighter. So I always wanted wavy hair. And so I would braid my hair so that I'd get a little wave in it. Well, my best friend had the most beautiful wavy hair. I mean, the most gorgeous wavy hair. Of course, she used to straighten it every morning with a curling iron because she wanted straight hair. And I think there's this sense of dissatisfaction with whatever we have isn't quite okay. And there's a process that I think we go through with aging, as well as with wisdom, where we just begin to accept that the body is a body, it's a physical form, and it is what it is, and we can open to that and accept it without so much discontent, a discontent that doesn't serve our lives, it doesn't serve wisdom. It really only serves the fashion and cosmetic industry. There's a beautiful poem of one of the early Ambapali, one of the early Buddhist nuns, and in Susan Murcott's book, The First Buddhist Women, she translates it. And Ambapali was a very, very beautiful woman, and in her old age, she's reflecting back on her body, saying, "My hair was black and curly, the color of black bees. Now I am old, and it is like the hemp of trees. It was thick as a grove, and I parted it with comb and pin. Now, because of old age, it is thin, very thin." And she goes about describing her hair and how it's aged and gotten old. And then she describes her eyebrows and how they're sagging and drooping. And then she describes her eyes that used to flash like jewels, but now they don't make anybody look back, she says. Then she talks about her earlobes and how now they used to sparkle and be decorated with earrings, but now they sag and are wrinkled. And she talks about her teeth, and she goes all the way down. I mean, it's like a body scan meditation, but but with these poetic reflections, all the way part by part by part by part, all the way down to her feet. Noticing the aging, changing, wrinkling, sagging, drooping quality of age. And I think it can be very helpful sometimes. I ask my group to do this at home, which is to just visualize our own bodies aging. And I'd like to spend just a silent couple of minutes where you picture your body just as it is now. And then picture it aging a bit. If you're young, you might go and figure 10 years. If you're older, you might go 2 years. And then picture it aging a little more. And then a little more. And imagine your face and your body a little bit older until you're getting into old age. You might notice how the teeth are changing, how the skin is changing, how the hair is thinning. And then imagine yourself a little older and a little older. Slowly approaching death. It can be very interesting to consider our own aging process. I have an aunt who's now about 95, something like that. Maybe 94, 96. At some point, it's hard to keep track. She told me last year, she said, "Ugh, I didn't feel this age until 91, and I don't like it at all." Yeah, 'cause she had a very good constitution, but boy, when it comes, you know, the aging, once the pain hits and the arthritis, and when she's living with constant pain, the whole body starts to age very, very rapidly. But she was funny because her sister died at 101. Her older sister died at age 101. About 6 or 7 years ago. And she said just recently, she said, "Oh, I'm missing her so much. I didn't expect her to die so soon." Well, we'll get to contemplation of death soon, but it is an interesting thing that sometimes we really don't expect either to age or to die, and it can be a shock. The mindfulness practice invites us to really know that intimately, deeply, that we all do age and we all will die. There are traditional body-oriented meditation practices. I've been, for the last several years, doing the 32 parts of the body as a regular feature of my meditation practice, where we contemplate the body from the top of the head to the tip of the toes. And the language of the Satipatthana Sutta says, "A bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin and full of many kinds of impurity. Thus, in this body, there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, brain." Well, the old texts didn't have brain, but the later texts did, so we add brain. "Bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus: this is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So, too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body. In this way, he contemplates the body as a body internally, externally, and both internally and externally, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This contemplation of the 32 parts of the body is a wonderful practice. When you think about it, what we have an awful lot of judgments, not only about our own body, but about other bodies. Some bodies we find attractive and other ones we find repulsive. But what do we actually see? We see head, hairs, body, hairs, nails, teeth, skin. That's about all we see. Okay, once in a while we'll see snot and spit. But usually it's head, hairs, body, hairs, nails, teeth, skin. These first five parts of the body is basically what we experience, what we see every day when we judge our bodies or other bodies. How often do you reflect on the interior part of your body, on the sinews, the flesh, the kidneys? We enjoy our food when we put it in our mouth, but do you reflect upon the whole process of it being digested and then being excreted? It's not quite as appealing when it comes out as when it went in. We don't say, oh, what delicious food. No. In Thailand, part of the traditional meditations on the bodies include contemplating the corpse. And many devout Buddhists would offer their bodies to their local village monastery after they die. And the body would be prepared for contemplation. So it would either be preserved, you know, kind of drained of fluids and preserved in a glass case so that it could last for many years. And people could just come and sit next to it and watch the body slowly, slowly kind of shrivel up and shrivel up. It's kind of what happens to it. Or they would be prepared as skeletons and hung in the meditation hall. There was one time I went to a monastery and I was waiting in the waiting room. I was just escorted in because I needed to ask permission to stay at the monastery. So I was waiting for the abbot to grant me an audience. And I was escorted into this waiting room. And there was a big chair in the room. So I just sat down in the chair. And I looked at what was right in front of me and there was this skeleton. And then I looked to the side and there were more skeletons. And then I looked around and there were corpses that were in cases, and there were fetuses that were in formaldehyde, and there were bodies basically in various states of, one could say, preservation or decomposition. And there were photographs all over the walls of accidents, car accidents. It was quite a room. It was not the usual decor. But the purpose was to contemplate the body. It was to contemplate the inevitability of death. The Satipatthana describes the charnel ground meditations as, again, bhikkhus, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus: this body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. And with this meditation, you usually start with a fresh corpse, you know, one that is recently died. And most people, not everybody, but most people, excuse me. Most people have at one time or another seen a corpse. Somebody in the family has died, or you know, some time when you've been with somebody who has died, or arrived shortly after, or been to a funeral service where the body was presented. Before burial or cremation. And so you begin with the visualization of the body that you actually had seen. And then if you have seen a body in the various states of decomposition, the livid body, the oozing body, the one that's fleshless with a skeleton smeared with blood, and the one that's being devoured by animals and this and that, scattered. It goes through all these various stages of the body decomposing. It's not so much that the stages are of much concern. It's that we take the time to reflect that there is a process of decomposition of this body. Just as we reflected on the aging process, that we also will age, we see a corpse and we reflect on the decomposition of that corpse until it completely disappears into dust. And then after that, after we've contemplated the decomposition of the corpse through all the stages with the corpse we've actually seen, then we visualize ourselves dying, dead, and our own body going through that decomposition process. And then we visualize people that we know, people that we love, with an emphasis on the people that we have the strongest attachment to, so that we contemplate this, the impermanence of all corporeal forms, you know, of all these bodies. And it's a very powerful and interesting meditation practice to do. The important part of it is to not just see, oh, that corpse is decomposing. It's to reflect, I too am of that nature. This body also will be like that. And that's the emphasis in the Satipatthana Sutta, to see the aging process and to reflect that we are subject to that same process, to see the process of death and decay, and to know that this body also will go through that process. So let's take a moment of silence and allow yourself to just, for a moment, picture your own body. Well, start with somebody who, usually it takes a while, but if you can just picture a corpse that you have seen. And sometimes we would stay with this so long that we would enter into deep states of absorptive concentration with each stage of the contemplation. But it's enough for tonight just to visualize some corpse that you've seen. And then realize that you also will die. And picture in the place of that corpse, as though it's outside of you, your own body, in that death, in that posture of death, however you saw the person. And to know that very quickly the body starts to decay. It's no longer held together, it starts to ooze, change color. And slowly just imagine the body decomposing. Literally, it rots away. It doesn't have to be gross. It's actually what happens. It rots away. Until finally there's only bones. And visualize your own bones. In time they get more and more brittle. And eventually they also fall apart and become dust. that might make you all want to be cremated. Who knows? In our sitting meditation, we've been working with the posture quite a bit this last day and a half. And this afternoon, we added the sitting, the walking, the standing, and the reclining to include the four primary postures. And I think at any time, you can release your attention just into the posture, to bring your attention into the body, however it's currently arranged. Sitting, standing, walking, reclining, and just feel that contact with the earth, that connection with gravity, that way of being on this planet. The stillness of the sitting posture doesn't need to deny the body. In fact, many forms of awareness practice include a movement component so that we embrace our awareness in movement. Different forms of Tai Chi and Qigong, the Alexander technique, Feldenkrais, yoga, walking meditations, and various forms of mindful movement, traditional and contemporary, encourage a real alive attention to the body. But there can also be a deep quality of body work that occurs in the stillness of the sitting. So whether during movement or in stillness, you can become aware of the ingrained conditioning of the body and find a free relationship to that conditioning. There was a time in the, about the 80s, when a lot of the instruction I was getting in the United States was very rigorous about maintaining the posture. You know, really, really sitting totally still, making a vow not to move. You know, if you have to blow your nose, you don't blow. They would say, let it drip. You know, don't swallow. Just, you know, just really, really maintain the still posture. Don't blink. Don't, you know, just really maintain that strong, strong integrity of the stillness. And there was a kind of intensity that would come with that, a kind of a very strong discipline. Now, I don't teach that way anymore, and most of the groups that I practice with also don't teach that way anymore. It's not that we don't encourage people to individually choose some periods in their practice where they want to make that kind of a strong vow that they're just going to sit still and really feel what is in the body, but we no longer impose that upon a whole group, because different people are at different places, and sometimes the factors are ripe to really do that kind of strong practice, and we know that we can without injuring ourselves emotionally or physically. But there are other times when we have to be much more responsive to the needs of the body. And so there might be a time in your practice where you decide, maybe not for the whole hour, but you decide for the next 10 minutes, I'm not going to move. You know, no matter... You know, you make that vow, and there's going to all of a sudden be 10 itches. And, you know, all of a sudden you'll get cold, and you'll want your shawl, and you think, I should have put my shawl on before I made this vow. You know, but you made a vow, so you have to stay for your 10 minutes. But you might want to explore it, but I would suggest exploring this kind of strong, intense practice in small increments so that you pick times when it's appropriate for you to do it. When you feel like you already have the mindfulness and the concentration that will support it. I've been practicing the last several years with a Burmese teacher, Pawak Sayadaw, who is probably the strongest meditator I've ever met. And because of my back injury, because of the car accident I was in a long time ago now, I guess more than a decade ago, I'm limited as to how long I can sit. He usually likes people, after a short time, to be sitting 2, 3, 4 hours, stretches. And I refuse. So we've had to have a few discussions about it. But now I've incorporated, he's understood that I incorporate the sitting and the standing and the sitting and maintain the integrity of the meditation, but I still just change the posture. So we've come to some understanding. But it was really hard for a while until he understood that I wasn't going to sit for more than my back could do. Because the first retreat, I pushed too hard. And I ended up having to go through a whole other course of very expensive medical treatment and very painful medical treatment after that course. So I think it really is important to be sensitive to what is appropriate for your body and not overpush, especially when you really can incorporate the standing and the sitting and find a flow that keeps your mind concentrated, keeps your mind attentive and the mindfulness developing without putting undue strain on the body. When we are ill, sick, or in pain, sometimes we'll feel shame or we'll feel that it's a kind of personal weakness or failure. Some people come to meditation practice expecting or hoping that meditation will cure their pain or their illness. And I mean, meditation does transform the body in many ways, but I'm not one to say that it's going to cure you of whatever ailment that you have. However, I do find that the Dhamma practice really increases our capacity to open to pain. Now, you might wonder, why on earth would I want to open to pain? But when we do open to pain, and when we really are present for the pain that is, then there's no more resistance to it. And so the degree of suffering diminishes. When we're aware of the subtleties of the body and also the way the mind contracts around certain sensations or releases around others, then we find that we'll increase our capacity to just be with whatever measure of pain comes with this physical condition. When we're sick, it's a great time to practice. Okay, it's a little annoying to be interrupted by coughing and sneezing and all those various inconveniences. But there's a lot of experiences that we have of the body when it's sick, which show us another part of the vulnerability of this body. The mind often gets dull. We can't maintain the same rigorous concentration. The body gets tired. It gets achy in different ways. You've probably all at one point or another had a fever, and it can be very interesting to meditate through a fever, to feel the changes of heat and cold, to feel if you've had surgery or a medical procedure, to feel the healing of the body after an intensive operation, to know even just simply how your body responds to different kinds of foods, different kinds of drugs or medications. They can have a very physical response in the body, and we can bring mindfulness to that response. When we're sick, we can't expect our practice to be as clear and powerful as when we're healthy. So I find that illness is a great time to practice patience and compassion, to practice acceptance, and that quality that just allows things to be as they are. But most importantly, it's a time to practice equanimity. We never know when the moment of our death will come. The only thing we know for sure is that we will die. So when we practice with illness, we're practicing in a way to prepare for our dying. In a way, we get used to the idea when we're sick, that this body is indeed vulnerable. Another aspect of embodied practice is to restrain the sense doors. Now, this means a little restraint around tasting, seeing, hearing, smelling, touching. With restraint, I don't mean putting on blindfolds. I don't mean putting in earplugs. I don't mean not tasting anything. I don't know how you do that, actually. I guess eat chili and then you can't taste anything else. I don't know. But it's not about not experiencing any senses. It's about restraint at the senses. And the force of restraint, the force for restraint is that of mindfulness. To bring mindfulness forward so that when you receive something at the senses, mindfulness, you meet it with mindfulness. So when you see something, you meet it with mindfulness of seeing. As you hear, you meet it mindfully. As you taste, you have the intention to really be mindful of the tasting. Notice where the eye strays. Does it pull you into trouble? What about the ear? Does it go off contemplating lots of different sounds and thinking about this or that? What about the tongue? Does it crave flavors that cause you agitation or cost you a lot in health or addiction? Where does the mind stray? Does it stray into fantasies? Constant self-created stories that entertain yourself, planning, worrying, anxiety. There's a lot of trouble in that trip. When we're on retreat, it's a great opportunity to bring mindfulness to the sense doors. And if you do notice the eyes reaching out for contact, pulled out with that craving, then rein it in a bit. Keep the eyes a little bit downcast. If you feel balanced, I think there's nothing wrong with looking around. I don't think we have to practice looking at the floor in any kind of grim feeling. But if you feel like you're always out there seeking something else, then pull that energy in a bit. Let yourself just stay a little bit more steady. Notice how you respond to the tea. It is available between meals. And how often do you go to get a cup of tea? Notice if you've decided to walk out, put on your shoes, and without even thinking about it, you got your shoes and you're on your way to the dining room to go get yourself a cup of tea. Was there really, could you stop, can you stop for a moment in your tracks and feel the desire to go get a cup of tea? Well, why do you want a cup of tea? Are you thirsty? First consider if there's thirst. There's nothing wrong with a cup of tea. But notice what the motivation is, so that you can engage in that process mindfully. When you reach the tea urn and you prepare your tea, notice the experience of it, how you make your decision, whether you're going to put this leaf or that stick in, or mix up some coffee, whatever. Notice if there's disappointment, if they didn't happen to have the whatever it was you were hoping for. And then when you take your tea, and you sit down or go someplace to sit and drink it, notice what your experience is. First, feel it. Feel the physical experience of the tea. But notice more your relationship to it, the mind's relationship to it. Are you considering it a break? Well, you must have noticed by now that we don't have breaks in the schedule except for that few minutes to stretch before the Dhamma talk. There's really no breaks there. So every activity continuously from waking until sleeping is one to engage in mindfully. So even if you get a cup of tea, it's not a break from mindfulness. Incorporate that into your mindfulness so that you're aware of what is the motivation. If you rest your happiness upon getting a cup of tea, or if you seek comfort in a particular physical experience, notice what that is. Is it the getting? Is it the having? What makes it gratifying for you? And what is the experience of gratification? So incorporate that whole process into your awareness. And you might find that then your decisions as to whether you want a cup of tea or not and your relationship to it will become wiser and wiser. You'll be able to make a very wise decision as to when and what to consume. In daily life, we consume a lot of things. We consume books and reading and entertainment and movies and TV and food and drink and newspapers and talk and gossip and this and that. It's no wonder we live with so much internal pressure when you think about all the stuff that we bring, take in from the senses. It's a wonderful thing to just spend some time in simplicity and silence, eating simple food, being in the company of people where we feel safe, who are also developing their mind. Now, another aspect of embodied awareness is to just consider our gender. How comfortable are you having a male body or a female body? Now, certainly there's no problem with having either a male body or a female body, but how do you relate to maleness or femaleness? Do you relate to a way that is in a way that's either grasping or aversive? Or are you okay with gender, both your own and that of another? How comfortable are you in an ambiguity of gender? Cross-dressing, transsexuals, transgendered individuals. Are you comfortable with that too? Historically, the uncertainty around gender has often been used as a form of comedy, because it can easily create a kind of anxiousness and uncertainty. And Shakespeare's, have you seen Shakespeare's plays? Most Shakespeare comedies have one character or another who's dressed as the opposite sex and is confused for being who they're not, and then somebody falls in love with them that doesn't know, and then they twist around, and there's all of this cross-dressing that occurs in Shakespeare comedies. And it's really quite amusing. And part of why it's amusing is there's often a deep human discomfort when we don't know somebody's gender. We don't know what they are. It's often the first thing that we recognize with somebody. Now, when I went to India for the first time, and it was around 1990, I had very, very short hair then, and I was wearing pants. And when I met my teacher, Punja, he was accustomed to women having long hair and not wearing pants, you know, wearing those Indian dresses or what do they call the the salwar kurta things and the saris. And I stayed with him for quite a few years, but it was only a short time after I met him that he pretty much invited me into his home like a granddaughter. But right along with that invitation came a dress. It came Indian clothing. You know, he didn't want me to be wearing pants, and he wanted my hair to grow. You know, he used to joke and call me a little boy, because it was it was kind of a joke to him. But I remember that because there's just this very deep discomfort when we don't know the gender, because we're so often identified with the body, and that's such a common experience socially to relate to people primarily first through their gender. The primary way we work with mindfulness of our bodies is through the sensations that we experience. Just now, you've been sitting for quite a while. What sensations do you feel? Do you feel some achy muscles, some tingling, some pressure, some heat, some coolness, some hardness, some piercing, roughness, lightness, tension? There's a kind of physicality in the body. And primarily in the mindfulness practice, we bring attention to that physicality. This practice is not about becoming expert breath watchers, nor about becoming expert body watchers. We're working with the mind and its relationship to experience. So when we're mindful of sensation, we notice what the sensation is. We notice if it's pleasant, if it's unpleasant, and we notice something about the sensation. We notice that it's impermanent. We We notice that it's changing, that it comes, that it goes, that it wasn't present before it appeared, and that it is not present when it's absent. We can notice painful sensations as just a constellation of points of sensation. It's not so unendurable when we bring mindfulness to pain. The concept pain is hard to endure, but the actual experience of prickling and heat and burning and throbbing and aching and pulsing, it's just that. It's just sensations in the body. When our practice feels dull, and we're sort of with the in-breath and we're sort of with the out-breath, but we can't quite say what's really happening with it, then it can be very helpful to use the body as a resource and to feel the touch points or to feel the breath more closely, to really see how it's changing. To notice our relationship to those sensations and to see if there is some that are affected by desire, wanting, liking, and some that are affected by aversion, anger, withdrawal, not liking. Walking meditation is one of my favorite ways of just really opening to the body as it is and as the sensations are changing, because that's what you're noticing with the lifting of a foot, changing sensations. The moving of the foot forward, it's changing sensations. The placing of the foot, changing sensations. There's no foot. And if you're really mindful, you won't be able to find foot. You'll just feel this flow of changing sensations through each and every step. Now, we can bring that kind of intense noticing of sensations to many activities throughout the day. But please be considerate as to when you decide to do very slow sensory experiences. For instance, in the food line, with everybody hungry behind you, it's not a time to go really, really slow and feel the weight of the serving spoon as you reach. But once you sit down, you can sit with your plate, and you can eat very, very mindfully and feel the sensory experience, feel the texture, feel the temperature, feel the chewing, feel how the food transforms in your mouth. Notice the swallowing. Notice when you're breathing, if you're swallowing on an in-breath or an out-breath or with the relationship of breath while you're chewing. Notice you're sitting while you're eating, while you're breathing, while you're chewing. It's kind of like doing one of these things where you have to, you start to get really coordinated. When you're showering in the morning, when you're combing your hair, when you're brushing your teeth. Now, just again, choose a time when somebody isn't waiting for the space that you're in. But when you're getting your pajamas on in the evening, do it very mindfully. Feel the change of taking off one set of clothes and putting on another set of clothes. And see if you can experience the different sensations, but also your response to those different sensations. Some we like, some we don't like. We can be mindful not only of the direct sensations, but also that response to what's happening and our response to the meditation. Deep meditation can sometimes transform the mind, and it feels like that transformation is happening on the cellular level, and it can be deeply healing. We can allow states of tranquility, of peacefulness, of joy, of rapture, of delight, of calmness to pervade and suffuse every cell of our body. When the practice gets deep and the mind is experiencing profound rest and openness, we don't need to explain or interpret or control the meditation so much. It's as though everything is vividly known. We all have bodies. We don't need to reject them. We don't need to judge them. They keep us alive. There's pleasure, there's pain. But whether pleasant or painful, it's just sensations that are being known. How do we respond to them? Freedom is not dependent upon our beauty or our age. It's not dependent upon our gender or the shape of our bodies. It's not dependent upon which posture we are occupying. Many of us know people who have been quite ill and still have very radiant, clear, and beautiful minds. The text that the Buddhist discourses are filled with stories of people who have been awakened, some while doing walking meditation, some while doing sitting meditation, some while listening to a Dhamma talk, some while reclining meditation, some while reaching for something or doing an activity. When we're with the difficult experience in the body, the pain, the frustration, the agitation, we can find a way of being with that fact of things in a way that brings ease and peace, so that we train ourselves to be present through the difficult, and therefore we train ourselves to be present right up until the moment of our own death. The Buddha articulated a direct and wonderful practice of mindfulness of the body that frees us from clinging, so that we embody our freedom, not just our suffering. You know your freedom as you sit, as you stand, as you swallow, as you digest, as you eat, as you shower. You know your freedom in health and in illness. And right in the flurry of the mind's activity, how present are you right now for your embodied life? Let's have a few minutes of silence.